This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 8th of October. Benjamin Netanyahu has claimed that Israeli forces have killed Hezbollah's next two leaders, and he's told the Lebanese people to rise up and stop their country from experiencing the destruction and suffering of Gaza. We get the latest from Beirut and speak to a Lebanese MP who's allied with Hezbollah's political wing. We'll also consider how the war in the Middle East might end. Plus, new allegations about a high-profile head teacher in Wales who's been sentenced to jail for sexually abusing young girls. The scramble to leave parts of Florida as what could be the worst hurricane in a century approaches. And has it been a good evening for meteor gazing? If yesterday was the first anniversary of the Hamas attacks on Israel, today was the first anniversary of Israel's response. The war in Gaza began on October the 8th last year, as did what was initially a fairly low-key simmering conflict along Israel's northern border after the Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah began firing rockets into Israel in solidarity, they said, with Hamas. Well, today, with Israel's week-long air and ground campaign in Lebanon widening and Hezbollah's longtime leader Hassan Nasrallah dead, it was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu who linked the events in Gaza to Lebanon. In a televised address, he claimed that Israel had followed up the killing of Hassan Nasrallah by condemning his next two unnamed successors to a similar fate. And he addressed the Lebanese people directly.
Don't let these terrorists destroy your future any more than they've already done. Stand up and take your country back. You have an opportunity that hasn't existed in decades. An opportunity to take care of the future of your children and grandchildren. You have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza.
Well, the Israeli military has been rather more circumspect about whether Hassan Nasrallah's likely successor was killed in an airstrike in Beirut last Friday, but it has widened its ground campaign, sending troops into southwest Lebanon. The mayor of Beirut has said there is no safe place in the Lebanese capital, where more evacuation orders were issued by the IDF this evening. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has continued firing rockets into Israel. And today, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued this warning.
The Middle East is a powder keg with many parties holding the match. The situation in the occupied West Bank is boiling over. And now in Lebanon, attacks, including on civilians, are threatening the entire region. Over the last few days, exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and others in Lebanon and the Israel Defense Forces have intensified across the Blue Line in total disregard of Security Council Resolutions 1701 and 1559.
With warnings of the conflict in the Middle East expanding even further, we will nevertheless look at the prospects for peace on the programme this evening. But first, we will consider today's developments in Lebanon, both that widening ground war, the continuing air war, and that claim from Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel has killed more senior Hezbollah figures. In a moment, we'll speak to a Lebanese MP who is allied with Hezbollah's political wing. First, though, the BBC's Anna Foster is in the capital, Beirut, and a short while ago, she described the situation there.
Tonight, again, Jamie, the sound of loud explosions has echoed around the capital, and we're seeing again these black plumes of smoke rising above the rooftops. I'm just looking, actually, Lebanon's national news agency, a sort of state news agency, is suggesting that four adjacent residential buildings have collapsed in the southern suburbs of Beirut. But it's extraordinary in many ways that this is becoming almost the nightly norm now. Some of these airstrikes come with warnings from the IDF for people to evacuate certain areas, but some of them don't. Some of them come with no warnings at all. And when you look at what's been happening in the south of Lebanon today as well, the government says that 137 And that was before these strikes that I'm telling you about that have happened in the last hour. 137, they said, Israeli airstrikes across the Bekaa Valley, the south of Lebanon and Beirut just today.
Less normal, this direct appeal from the Israeli Prime Minister to the people of Lebanon, telling them to stand up and take their country back, that they have the opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war. What's the reaction been to that where you are?
Yeah, that's some interesting messaging, isn't it? And it's suggestive that the people of Lebanon have some sort of choice over this. I mean, I've been speaking to Lebanon's former prime minister, Fouad Siniora, who was the PM at the time of the war in 2006. And he described the way that Lebanon had been hijacked, in his words, kidnapped by Hezbollah. This was not something that people chose, for Iran to sort of come in and use Lebanon in this way. And the majority of people here did not want this conflict, which is unfolding now, which leads you to believe that message from Benjamin Netanyahu earlier, very similar to the one that he made to the people of Iran last week, is not necessarily directed at those grassroots individuals in those countries, but is more a message that he's sending to the English-speaking world as well, because neither of these messages were in the local language.
And he was also rather less equivocal than the IDF about whether or not the presumed next leader of Hezbollah has been killed.
There's been some to-ing and fro-ing on that today. And what we tend to use as the confirming marker for something like this is whether or not Hezbollah confirm it themselves. And we did hear earlier today one of these recorded statements from Naim Qassam, the group's deputy leader, making the kind of speech that Hassan Nasrallah used to make. And he was saying that they hadn't elected a replacement for Hassan Nasrallah yet. I think they're hedging their bets, because the speed at which Israel is dispatching many of Hezbollah's commanders, I think, makes them nervous that if they name somebody else and that person is then killed, it continues to give Israel the upper hand, as they would see it.
Briefly, a final thought. There is already a lot going on the humanitarian front, is there not? Just bring us up to date with the situation for the people of Lebanon at the moment.
The displacement crisis here is huge. There are different things going on here. The shelters are full, more than full. Around 700 of them are at capacity at the moment. It's something like a fifth of the population here who are displaced. You've got around 400,000 Syrians who have decided that actually they are better to go back to their own country from where they fled a civil war than stay here in Lebanon at the moment. And you've got the difficulties as well of trying to bring aid in, because the airport's operations are very limited now. We're seeing some aid come in by air, but there's this constant concern that the airport may be taken out of action at any time. And all of that combined is making the situation for civilians here incredibly difficult.
The BBC's Anna Foster in Beirut. Well, Fadi Alemi is chair of the Lebanese Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. He sits with the Development and Liberation Bloc of the Amal movement, a Shia Muslim party, which is traditionally allied with Hezbollah. And I asked him for his reaction to Benjamin Netanyahu's appeal to the Lebanese people.
I think it's the Lebanese internal affairs strictly belongs to the Lebanese themselves. And this is not the first time others interfere in Lebanon's internal issues. The issue that we have, the war that we have, might be with some Lebanese not in agreement with what's happening now. But I think the Lebanese, once they're pressured, they can sit down and they can resolve all their issues together. They've done it over the years. But for that to happen, given the current circumstances here, I think the whole country is unified around one thing, which is to bring about an immediate ceasefire and also to go back and implement the 1701, the UN Resolution 1701, from both sides, full implementation of that 1701, and allowing the Lebanese army to play a major role.
Are Lebanese politicians now in a position where they can say to a weakened Hezbollah, look, you just have to stop firing rockets into Israel, you have to withdraw north of the Litani River as the Resolution 1701 demands? Is this now a time when can happen?
Well, I think there was a statement issued by the Prime Minister, the Speaker, and Minister Jumblat of the Socialist Party. And it was very clear by stating that we need a ceasefire, we need a full implementation of 1701, and then we need to elect a president. That statement that was collectively issued 2 days ago, I think, got the momentum and got the support of most of the Lebanese and those who know the Lebanese politics, they know how complicated it is.
As you say, Lebanese politics is complicated, but has the deaths of these senior figures in Hezbollah had an impact, do you think, on the support of Hezbollah in Lebanon, on what the people think of it?
I think what's really impacting the Lebanese people is the number of the casualties so far. In excess of 2,000 people died, mostly civilians, 10,000 or plus injured, 1.2 million displaced. That's really impacting what's happening in Lebanon at this point, and that's going to be the priority.
But that is a sentiment that Benjamin Netanyahu appears to want to tap into, to say, look, this is because of Hezbollah, and if Hezbollah was not doing what it has been doing to the Israeli people, you, the Lebanese, would not be in the predicament you are now.
Well, if Israel goes back to the United Nations marked borders of Lebanon back in 1949, and it just leaves the 13 territorial disputed points that belong to Lebanon, and I think we should have a stable border.
Do you think that Hezbollah can survive this?
I'm not sure about the whole country being able to survive. It's not only Hezbollah. This war is impacting every single Lebanese in every single corner. There's a big challenge in how we're going to deal with the displaced. There's a big challenge in how we're going to go back and rebuild the economy after all the destructions and all the massive damage that's taking place. It's a big challenge now for the whole Lebanon.
Well, challenges have been there for many years already, haven't they? What will it mean for Lebanon if a ceasefire is not in place soon, if what is happening at the moment continues for much longer?
It's more casualties, more civilian casualties, more destruction, more miseries, bigger numbers of displaced. It's really bad at this point. And we don't want to see Gaza all over again in Lebanon.
The Lebanese MP, chair of the Lebanese Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, Fadi Alemi. Well as bringing you the latest developments in the Middle East, we across the BBC today are examining how the war might end and the prospects for some kind of longer-term peace. On yesterday's programme, we heard some thoughts from the region about how to bridge the gap between Israelis and Palestinians. This was Israeli medical student Bar Mizrahi, whose kibbutz was attacked by Hamas militants on the 7th of October last year.
The citizens in Gaza, I hope that they will take down this government of terrorists, Islamic radicals, and make a peaceful government that want to coexist with Israel.
The Palestinian journalist Tahada Auda told me what the people she had spoken to in central Gaza think needs to happen now.
They want both sides to end the fighting, and not only for the Israelis, also for Hamas, just to save the rest of the people's lives, you know.
So the people of Gaza, you think they blame Hamas as well as Israel for what's happening?
Actually, they don't blame Hamas by itself. They blame both sides. Even they blame Arab countries, international community.
The idea of a two-state solution, the state of Israel coexisting alongside a sovereign Palestinian state, is a proposal that most countries see as a prerequisite for peace in the region, although it has been rejected by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the current Israeli parliament, although some Israeli politicians are still in favour of it. I've been speaking to one of them, Yossi Beilin, who was Israel's justice minister, helped to initiate the Oslo peace accords between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organisation in the 1990s, and to Jonathan Kutab, an international human rights lawyer who was on the Palestinian legal team during that Oslo process. He no longer sees a two-state solution as viable, and he told me why.
I think the old paradigms have been broken down. And the reason why they have is because Israel has persistently put obstacles before the two-state solution. While occasionally mouthing the words two states, they have been very busy putting up settlements, putting up obstacles, creating new facts on the ground, to the point where it's no longer feasible to do a two-state solution. And also, there's something else that needs to be thought about, which is that we really need to think in new terms. And I think fresh thinking requires that we also reconsider the idea of two states and see if people can live together rather than be separated from one another.
But live together in what single state? An Israeli state? A Palestinian state? Surely neither side will accept that.
Live together in a pluralistic state that addresses the needs and concerns of both sides. This myth that Jews and Arabs can't live together is a myth. For about 13 centuries, Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived more or less in peace. I think the idea of having a separate Jewish state and a separate Arab state vying for the same territory is a zero-sum solution. So we need to move beyond that into a state that has justice, equality, and allows both peoples to thrive on the basis of equality rather than hatred and bitterness and separation.
Yossi Beilin, what do you make of that idea?
No way. No way. It will never happen. What may happen, this is what I'm trying to promote in the last 10 years with my partner, Dr. Hiba Husseini, is the idea of an Israeli-Palestinian confederation. Confederation of two sovereign and independent states, which will live side by side with a high level of cooperation. I think that speaking about one democratic state is totally, I mean, people like myself will fight in the streets against it, because I don't want to give up on the UN resolution from 1947, which accepted the idea of a Jewish state side by side with an Arab state. And to think that after so many years, a state which was recognized by the UN and by the whole world should disappear and become part of another state is something which is a total delusion, or if you want, an illusion, but it is not realistic and will not happen.
Jonathan Kutab, if you can't get people like Yossi Beilin on board, it's just a non-starter, isn't it, your idea?
I'm sure that it feels impossible at the time. Just like ending apartheid in South Africa appeared impossible, ending slavery in the United States, ending colonialism and imperialism, providing equality, even between men and women, appeared totally impossible at the time. But eventually it happened. And what I'm saying is, when we fail, when the old ideas fail, we must be open to new ideas, however difficult they may appear.
Do you see partners for peace on the other side? Both of you, Yossi, first of all.
I see partners on the other side. I have partners on the other side. I meet them even in such days. And I think that, first of all, the Palestinian president is somebody like that. He wants peace. He fought for peace. And although he is not becoming younger, unlike us, and although he is not becoming more popular, he is still one of the founding fathers. And if he signs a peace treaty with Israel, it will be respected in the Palestinian world, in the Arab world, and in the world at large. On the Israeli side, regretfully, right now, you don't have a partner, because Netanyahu is not a partner for peace. And we will have to do whatever we can in order, using the democratic tools, to shorten the term of this government.
Jonathan, is that how you see it? That while Benjamin Netanyahu is in post, the Palestinians don't have a partner?
Well, the very sad thing is that Netanyahu's position is shared by the majority of Israelis, that they do support his war on Gaza and his war on Lebanon, and in fact, his intended war beyond that on Iran. I do not see the numbers there in terms of an Israeli government that's willing to provide Palestinians with the very bare minimum of the two-state solution. And as long as they have the massive support of the United States, Britain, and some other Western countries, they think they can prevail.
So where does your idea of this single state, how does that come into being?
I wish the outside partners would at least stop interfering. I think it is possible to think, to envision, and to dream of a new reality that is a better one, both for Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs.
The Palestinian lawyer Jonathan Kutab and the former Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilon, who both worked on the Oslo Peace Accords in the 1990s, with their thoughts about the prospects for peace in the Middle East now.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
One of Wales's highest profile head teachers, who was given 17 years in prison for sexual crimes against girls earlier this year, may have abused victims for more than four decades. Neil Foden was found guilty of abusing four children in North Wales between 2019 and 2023. But a BBC Wales investigation has heard allegations going as far back as 1979. Serious concerns have also been raised about a review designed to learn lessons from Foden's case, although the local council has promised that a panel overseeing the review will be given all the information it needs. One former pupil has told BBC Wales she was in touch with Foden until the day of his arrest. Ellen Wynne's report begins with the moment that Neil Foden was arrested.
Mr. Foden, I need to arrest you on suspicion of sexual touching of a child and sexual communications with a child.
Neil Foden's final day of freedom. Just hours before his arrest, a former pupil says he was still sending her messages and that he'd been grooming her for 5 years.
There's about, I'd say, roughly 400, 500 on his personal email to my personal email account. It was back and forth every day, in school, out of school, morning, night, any time.
The woman, who we're calling Jo, grew up in care. Targeted by Foden, she says, when she had no one else to turn to. An actor speaks her words.
He made me feel like I was special. He just hugged me sometimes, just without reason, or his hands would go under my jumper. Multiple teachers saw me on multiple occasions get into his car alone. They'd make comments on how lucky I was to have him to drive me home.
Jo says she was deemed too vulnerable to testify against Foden at trial. He denied any wrongdoing, but convicted of sexual abuse crimes against four girls, she now understands the extent of his abuse.
The police came to me. According to them, there were over 20 other people who were in similar situations as myself.
Foden was a prominent figure in education locally and nationally, a head teacher, a union leader. The BBC Wales Investigates team has uncovered stories of his abuse going back more than 40 years, stories not told until now.
I know that he was doing it in 1979 because he was doing it to me.
This woman, we've changed her name to Nia, says Foden indecently assaulted her for 2 years when no one else was around. She didn't tell anyone at the time, but she did contact the police after his arrest. An actor speaks her words.
He'd come to the desk. Usually his right arm would be rubbing up against my breast and I felt I couldn't move. I must have been 13. I was vulnerable at that age, naive, and he knew it.
Now, several former pupils and staff are taking legal action against Cyngor Gwynedd, who used to employ Neil Foden. Catherine Yates, their lawyer, explains.
My oldest client is in her 50s. My youngest is 14.
And numbers are growing. The council are vicariously liable for the actions of their employees. Now, the children had no say in the employment of anyone. And his actions have impacted on so many lives, that of children, their families, staff. It's like the ripples on a pond. It goes on and on.
Cyngor Gwynedd, Foden's now former employer, declined a request for an interview. It said an official review is underway and will provide all the information it needs so that lessons can be learned. The Child Practice Review were unaware of Jo and Nia until we contacted them. but say they would now like to speak to both.
It's not just enough to say they need to do better. They need to be forced to do better.
Joe and others remain angry, not just with Foden for what he did, but with others about what they failed to do.
That was Ellen Wynne reporting, and you can watch the full BBC Wales Investigates documentary, My Head Teacher, the Paedophile, on BBC iPlayer. Hot on the destructive heels of Hurricane Helene, which has resulted in more than 225 deaths across six American states and several billion dollars worth of damage, Hurricane Milton is expected to make landfall on Florida's Gulf Coast sometime tomorrow. President Biden has postponed an overseas trip to oversee preparations for a storm that's been growing in size and strength over the past few hours. The president has not been mincing his words. Speaking at the White House, he warned that Milton could be the biggest storm to hit Florida in a century, and he stressed the need for people who could be affected to take urgent action.
Most importantly, I've urged everyone currently located in Hurricane Milton's path to listen to local officials and follow safety instructions. You all have been reporting on the highways, shoulders being opened, everybody's heading out. And if you're under evacuation orders, you should evacuate now, now, now. You should have already evacuated. It's a matter of life and death, and that's not hyperbole. It's a matter of life and death.
51 counties in Florida are currently under a state of emergency, and a short while ago, the Republican governor of the state, Ron DeSantis, issued this warning about the storm's uncertain path and about the possibility it could cause an abnormal and potentially highly dangerous sea level rise known as a storm surge.
I would just tell people, one, there's going to be impacts far beyond wherever the eye of the storm is. Two, you could make landfall anywhere from Citrus County down into southwest Florida. I know that there's a lot of folks who have evacuated, who are in those areas, and you absolutely could get whacked with really serious storm surge. Really, almost every place on the west coast of Florida could get major storm surge.
Well, we can join the BBC's Gordon Carrera, who is on the west coast of Florida in Tampa. And Gordon, just in the last few minutes, the authorities saying that the storm has strengthened to the maximum Category 5. What is the atmosphere like there? What are people bracing themselves for?
Well, there's certainly a sense of real concern here in Tampa from the few people who are left, I should say, because we passed lines of traffic leaving the city as we came in. There are still a few people here, but not many. The streets are pretty quiet. And the few people we've seen are basically boarding up their properties, their homes or their businesses in preparation for that storm surge hitting perhaps around 24 hours away. And so there is a realization that this is different, even in a place where hurricanes do come relatively frequently. The warnings have got through, whether it's from the mayor of Tampa right up to the president, that Milton could be much more serious than what they've seen before. The biggest storm potentially since 1921 to hit Tampa.
And just on the heels of Helene, we're going to hear in just a few minutes from someone who's was suffered during Helene, has had to leave again, but coming very quickly and unusually late in the hurricane season as well.
Yes, and I think what's really notable is where I am right now in Tampa, around me are piles of debris. I mean, huge piles of debris outside of houses, which is people's kind of floorboards, their, you know, furniture, their possessions, which I can see a mattress in front of me, which have been turfed out of their houses from Helene and from the damage caused by Helene here in this part of Tampa 2 weeks ago. But it's not been cleared up. And the problem is that the next storm surge is going to come from Milton. It's going to pick up all this debris and throw it around and do even more damage as well as it hits more properties. So I think the sense of one coming after the other, it is really tough on the people here in Tampa.
We heard the words of the president and the governor. What about the actions? What is in place in terms of trying to protect as best they can this part of Florida from what's likely to hit it?
Well, we've had mandatory evacuation orders in some areas and really clear messages for people to get out. Because the truth is, there's not much you can do to protect people who do stay. It's that dangerous. The power of nature is that strong. And so a lot of the real preparation is what to do afterwards. It's about the resilience. It's about picking up the pieces afterwards. And there's 10,000 beds, emergency beds, at a sports stadium nearby in St. Petersburg, which are for emergency workers who will be coming in to help with the cleanup afterwards. grid. They're also trying to work out how to get the power back on because they're so sure that so many power lines are going to go down. So it's really the preparations for what will come in the aftermath of Milton that the real effort is being seen now.
Gordon, many thanks. Gordon Carrera there in Tampa. Well, earlier on I spoke to Callie Johnson. She owns Bailey's General Store on Sanibel. That's an island, Sanibel, that's an island off the southwest coast of Florida, just to the south of where Gordon is. And she told me she'd just finished packing up her home and her parents' home and that they were just about to get in the car to drive out of town.
My house is ground level, so I'm pretty low, and we actually got water in Helene, so our house is already partially remediated, and all we had to do was pack all of our dry stuff up into a moving truck. And I just finished helping my parents get prepared. They're a little higher up, so we just put everything on the counters.
The fact you're talking about your dry stuff implies there's quite a lot of wet stuff in your house. How bad was it for you, Helene?
Not that bad. We only had about a foot of water in the house.
Just a foot. That feels like quite a lot, I think, to most people listening.
Well, it feels better than Ian when we had about 3 feet.
Remind me when Ian was.
That was 2 years ago. We just passed the anniversary on the 28th.
Where are you going to go? What are you going to do once you're packed up?
I'll be at my fiancé's grandma's house.
This is your family home and it has been for generations.
Yes.
So thoughts of moving far away, you're not entertaining them?
Not right now. We're pragmatic. We're pretty sure that things, you know, won't be like they used to be anymore. But we're also not ready to abandon our heritage here on the islands. And we run a historic general store.
And Hurricane Ian, when it came a couple of years ago, it did serious damage to your business, didn't it?
That's right. We have two stores. Bailey's General Store is our flagship store, and that was also the store that got 6 foot of water in it. And we decided instead of rebuilding that store, we would demolish the building and build a raised store. But we actually haven't gotten to break ground on that store yet.
You are sounding pretty chipper, Callie, if I might say so. But clearly this is a very uncertain time for you and your family, isn't it?
It is. And frankly, it's a bit laughable to have had Hurricane Helene come by. I actually last week was really proud of how quickly we cleaned out the house. Then when we realized this weekend that we needed to actually prepare to save the rest of our stuff, there certainly have been many tears along the way. And the situation is very serious. But I've been saying more and more, you can either laugh or cry. So.
And you said you're going to your fiancé's grandma's house.
Yes.
Am I right in thinking that you have a special occasion coming up soon?
We're supposed to be married on October 19th on Captiva, which is our sister island.
What is the forecast for there?
We're close enough that we have the same forecast. I believe currently it's 6 to 10 feet of storm surge.
You are possibly not wanting to think too much about that, are you?
Well, ideally, I'd love to get married on the 19th, but that is entirely possible that it won't happen. Humans are so flexible, but I think in the moment, you have to be okay with what's going to happen and then focus on what you can do to rebuild your life and then prevent worse things from happening in the future if possible.
Given the uncertainty, are you taking sort of mental photographs of Sanibel, just if the worst comes to the worst, that you will remember what it was like before the storm?
Yeah, absolutely. I learned a lot after Hurricane Ian of things I wanted to do differently. I'm sure I will learn again what I want to do differently. But as I'm talking to you right now, the trees haven't even regrown all of their leaves. It's certainly beautiful and paradise to me, but it's not the same as it was before Ian. It's not the same as it was before Hurricane Charley in 2004, because our landscape looks different from that. And it will be different once again.
Callie Johnson packing up there on her way off the island of Sanibel off the southwest coast of Florida. Now it is showtime up in the skies this evening, cloud cover permitting, because the annual Draconid meteor shower has been due to peak in the Northern Hemisphere today. Let's find out how it has been for meteor gazers. Joining us now, Dr. Sheila Kanani, who's a planetary scientist and an author. She's in Lytham St. Anne's in Lancashire. Good evening.
Good evening.
So how has it been?
Well, unfortunately, it's been very wet, very rainy and very cloudy. So as per usual, when these lovely things occur, I haven't seen anything.
Ah, meteor gazers lore. What a pity. Well, look, we've got plenty to talk about because we need to know what these Draconids are.
Yeah, absolutely. So meteor showers occur when the Earth travels through the debris of a comet. In this case, it was Comet 21P, and then a long name after the person who discovered it, Michael Giacobini. So 21P Giacobini-Zinna. And the debris is left behind from the comet. And as the Earth passes through the sort of comet tail debris, that debris can actually interact with our atmosphere, and specks as small as sort of dust and sand particles can cause these sort of shooting star like apparitions in our sky. The reason it's called the Draconids is because if we look at the radiant of those meteor shower tails, they appear to come from the constellation Draco, but actually they are all over the sky.
Now, if we look at them, as you say, it's not great meteor gazing weather tonight. I mean, we've still got a couple of days, I think.
Yeah. Today's supposed to be around the peak, but a couple of days still. You know, it is supposed to be a bit drier here anyway tomorrow. So I will definitely be looking up tomorrow night.
And looking up, and a very important question from my colleague Sarah here is, which direction do we need to look up to?
Yeah, fantastic. You can look for Draco. It's supposed to be a dragon, but with all these constellations, they kind of leave quite a lot to the imagination. But if you know where the plough is, Draco's tail is very near the plough, the bowl of the plough. But what you can do is just look up. If it is dry, you get warm, get comfortable, lie down, you know, on a beach or in your back garden. Let your eyes adjust to the sky. And if you're looking up and you're just sort of relaxing and enjoying the moment, you should be able to see some shooting stars tomorrow night.
Do we know what the weather forecast is?
I know for me it's supposed to be dry, but I don't know for anybody else.
Okay, well, if you're up there in Lancashire, then you just follow those instructions. Now, I mean, what is so special about this particular meteor shower? Because there are others, aren't there?
Yeah, there are others. We can sort of plan for them quite accordingly, and they do happen every year as we travel through different comet tail debris. The Draconids aren't particularly special, to be honest. And the problem is, because they happen in October in the Northern Hemisphere, it is winter, so the weather tends to be worse, and so it is harder to see. And they're not as strong. So there aren't as many meteors in the sky as, for example, the Perseids or the Leonids, which might happen in the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. So if you do see a Draconid meteor, then you're quite a special person to be able to spot one.
Right. Does that mean that it's the last big one of the year, or there are more to look forward to?
There are more to look forward to. There's one in December. But again, it all depends on the weather. And in the Northern Hemisphere in the winter, we do find that weather quite pesky.
Pesky weather. Well, look, it sounds like you might be lucky tomorrow. Thanks for a very...
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. A very comprehensive briefing there. Dr. Sheila Kanani there, planetary scientist, speaking to us from Lytham St. Anne's about the Draconids. Look in the direction of the plough is what she told us. Fingers crossed tomorrow might be better weather. Our closing headlines tonight. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that the military has killed the successor to Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah. Hashim Safieddine was targeted in an airstrike on Beirut on Friday. Mr. Netanyahu made the claim during a video address to the people of Lebanon, but Israel's military says it is still trying to confirm the results of that airstrike. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10, but for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.